This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, stand-up comics talking science, but first, some serious business. This week, the FDA finalized a rule that would allow more retail pharmacies, and we're talking big chains like Walgreens and CVS, to stock and fill prescriptions for the abortion drug mifepristone. The medication has been available only via certain specialty pharmacies or mail order. Joining me to talk about this and other science stories of the week is Catherine Wu, staff writer for The Atlantic based in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hello. Good to be here as always.
Thank you. Please explain the new rules for us about abortion pills.
Right. So earlier this week, the FDA gave the green light to big chain pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens, as you mentioned, to dispense these very important abortion pills. The move is expected to really expand access to these pills, with the catch that some states' restrictions around abortion pills may somewhat limit it. But for people who are pregnant and don't want to be in about half of states, at least this should make a massive difference.
And how much of a role do these pills play in the medical landscape?
So before Roe versus Wade was overturned, we were already seeing that about half of abortions were performed with medication, with these pills, mifepristone and misoprostol. And that percentage has been widely expected to increase now that, you know, surgical abortions are far less available.
So to be clear, this is not the morning after pill like Plan B, correct?
That's right. So these are two pills that people can take through about the 10th or 12th week of pregnancy, so still early on, really the first trimester. And the idea is to end an early stage pregnancy. The morning after pill is to prevent that pregnancy from even really taking hold in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And as you said before, these pills are accessible in about half the states.
So the tricky part here is, for instance, if CVS and Walgreens move forward with certification to be able to dispense these pills, which both have said that they're planning to do, that sort of should give blanket approval to, you know, any CVS or Walgreens to dispense these pills, fill these prescriptions. Just a note here that prescriptions are still required, so that has not been removed. These are not available over the counter. But the tricky thing is, you know, things may look very different in, say, Massachusetts versus Texas. We know that at this point, about half of states have at least some restrictions around abortion pills. For instance, some basically make it impossible to use the pills via telemedicine because you basically have to take them in the physical presence of a clinician. And some states, like Texas, have actually outright banned use of the pills past the 7th week of pregnancy. So it's a little tricky. Basically, the TLDR here is mileage may somewhat vary depending on what state you're in.
You say that restrictions are going to be different in different states. Are we going to see people leaving their own state and traveling to other states to get the pill?
It will be interesting to see if people start crossing state lines to access these pills. I mean, I believe that has already been happening to some degree because there have been restrictions around the pills even before this ruling. And we also know that is happening with surgical abortions. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is some travel to access this, but certainly not everyone has the resources to drive 8, 10, 20 hours to access abortion pills, which, you know, the big plus there is convenience.
Yeah. Let's move on to some other medical news. Of course, we're still in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and now there's a new variant, right? Tell us about that variant.
Right. So this newcomer is XBB.1.5, and it's actually been around for a few months. I think it was first detected around these parts, actually, in October. But after brewing sort of quietly in this big variant soup that we've been dealing with for quite some time, it really started to take off in December. In the last week of 2022, it went from 20% of estimated infections in the U.S. to 40%. And I think once the new numbers come out any minute from the CDC, we're going to see it taking over quite a bit more. It's already the vast majority of infections in the Northeast.
Do we know if this is really something new to worry about? Is it making people any sicker?
So far, there's no evidence to suggest that this is more inherently severe or likely to cause severe disease than previous variants, though I will caveat that by saying that it takes a while to sort of figure that out. We also know that, you know, some people's antibodies may be waning if they haven't gotten a recent bivalent shot, and people were mingling a lot over the holidays, so kind of a TBD on that front, but it is spreading remarkably fast. The WHO has already said that this is probably one of the most transmissible Omicron subvariants we've seen yet.
Wow. Do we know why this is taking over so easily?
Yeah, so kind of familiar stories that we've heard a few times now. It seems like two factors are driving this. One is that it is very good at evading antibodies that vaccines and previous variants have laid down in people. And also, it seems really, really good at latching on to the surfaces of our airway cells. And so that might make it easier for this variant to spread really quickly between people.
So once again, be vigilant, get boosted, mask where appropriate.
Right. I think the tricky thing is this is coinciding with the sort of post-holiday surge. We were already expecting a winter wave because of behavior and not enough people getting that bivalent shot, and this could make the impending surge worse.
Okay, let's move on to some other news, especially if you were watching Monday Night Football, you may have seen that really scary incident involving a 24-year-old Damar Hamlin, who collapsed and went into cardiac arrest on the field. Today, he seems to be doing a bit better, right?
Yeah, that's wonderful news. As far as I know, he is still in the ICU, but he has massively improved since Monday. I think it's going to be quite some time before he's back up on his feet, but we are hearing hopeful news from the Buffalo Bills and definitely wishing him a speedy recovery.
But we still don't know medically what happened. It's a bit of a mystery, right?
Right. I mean, this was an incredibly healthy young athlete who collapsed on the field. The most plausible explanations that experts have been putting forward this week, basically they're thinking there may have been some sort of pre-existing condition that made his heart a little bit weaker. And of course, we do need to remember there was a pretty big impact right before he collapsed. He had just tackled right. another player. And it's possible that a very rare incident in which the impact hit his chest at just the right moment in the cycle of his heart pumping might have sort of set his heart rhythm into flux and triggered a heart attack. It's sort of unclear. It could be a mix of factors coming together. But I think it's important to note here that a lot of misinformation has started to swirl around this because ambiguity just lets that stuff slide in. There is no evidence so far to suggest that vaccines have anything to do with it, but that hasn't stopped people from suggesting it.
Yeah, they'll always be there. Let's turn to something else. Let's turn to some space news. For the past 4 years, we've been hearing about Mars quakes, like seismic activity on Mars. And that comes from data taken by a lander called InSight. But InSight may be coming to an end. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think NASA has unfortunately called time of death on InSight, this plucky lander that was sending us news for more than 4 years. In mid-December, it sent its last communication to us here on Earth, and then NASA tried to contact it twice, didn't hear back two consecutive times, and basically near the end of the month, they said, "We think this is over." They declared the mission done, and that is it for InSight. So we are in mild mourning.
So that's sorry to hear that. It's a story of dusty solar panels once again.
That seems to be a big part of the issue, which is a little ironic because, you know, InSight got so dusty doing its hard work on Mars that it kicked up some dust onto its solar panels and just, you know, battery life is also a thing. So at this point, it seems like it does not have enough power to keep on collecting data.
And what have we learned from this mission?
So much. I mean, you know, before this, we really did not have good insight, into why Mars quakes were happening. And as you were saying, you know, this is shaking and rumbling on the red planet, the rough equivalent of earthquakes here on Earth. The difference is, you know, this is not like plates shifting up and below each other as they are here on Earth. Rather, it seems to be the outer crust of Mars shrinking and cooling and you know, sort of picture like an egg sort of drying out from the inside and maybe losing heat and creating some cracks. But really understanding how that process works might tell us how heat is seeping out of the planet's interior and maybe even turn the clock back, give us a sense of what Mars looked like billions of years ago.
So much to learn about that planet. It's really cool. Let's move on to an unusual wintertime visitor in Southern California. I'm talking about the snowy owl. Please fill us in.
Yes, finally, some cheery news. there was a snowy owl spotted in Southern California right after Christmas, and locals absolutely flipped their lids. They were so excited because it is absolutely bizarre to see a snowy owl this far south. I mean, it is kind of cool in Southern California right now, but it's certainly nothing like the Arctic, where they spend most of their time and have a lot of snow to camouflage them. But yeah, it's bonkers. One local I saw a quote that said it was like seeing Santa Claus on a beach, which I loved.
So the owl's totally out of its natural habitat is what you're saying.
It is. Normally they don't fly any further south than like the Canadian-US border. And this is way further south than that. This is kind of bonkers.
Wow. Let's move on possibly to our last story here. There's new research into this is crazy. An unusual connection between rats and reefs. Showing the interconnectivity of nature.
Right. So I think researchers have known for a while now that invasive rats taking over islands, you know, even intuitively, we can get a sense that is not a good thing. But they're really just starting to understand the full ripple effects of this kind of disruption. And they're starting to see that invasive rats can actually affect the behavior of tropical fish that hang out around coral reefs. So let's follow the sort of chain of events here.
Please.
Rats will eat the eggs and chicks of local seabirds, which means seabirds can't fly over the shore and deposit their feces into the soil to fertilize it, which means corals don't get enough nutrients to grow healthy and allow algal growth that feeds these damselfish. So these local damselfish are no longer protecting their territories as aggressively because they're thinking, oh, these corals suck. I don't want to guard this real estate anymore. And it's all the rats' fault.
So this is the ripple effect of invasive species.
Yeah. Rats are ruining everything is the tagline here.
And there you have it. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us, Catherine.
Always glad to do it.
Catherine Wu, staff writer for The Atlantic, based in New Haven, Connecticut. We have to take a break, and when we come back, science has never been more hilarious because we have stand-up comics telling us why they tell science jokes and why people laugh at them. Coming up after the break, as I say, stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of my favorite topics is the science of comedy or the comedy in science. And you know what? Sometimes I think about doing science stand-up like this. Let me try one out on you. A proton walks into a bar and asks the bartender for a beer. The bartender says, "Are you sure?" The proton says, "I'm positive." Ooh. How about this one? How do you get a baby astronaut to fall asleep? You rock it. Tough room. All right. I get the picture. Well, if you've listened to this show for even a little, you know that I love puns and dad jokes, whether they're good or not so good. Because when you tell a joke, good or bad, you get people's attention. So it can be a great way to talk about science, encourage people to listen, maybe even teach someone something new. Thankfully, there are people much better at telling science jokes than me. Professional comedians. Turning out joke after joke about physics, biology, and even research methodology. Yes, take this one from comedian Shang Wang about a common problem with medical research.
But how many more times are we going to have to read an article about how they found a new cure for cancer that only works on rats? Can we stop printing this article? Can we agree that does not belong in the human newspaper? Oh, man. That's rat news. That's wonderful for the rat community. Let them know. Let them know, but keep us out of that conversation.
That is funny. Here with me now to talk about their work as comedians with a nerdy twist are my guests. Kasia Patel, science journalist and stand-up comedian and founder of DC Science Comedy in Washington, D.C. Chuck Nice, 20-year veteran of stand-up comedy and co-host of Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And our very own Kyle Marin Viterbo, community manager at Science Friday and creator of the symposium, Academic Stand-Up NYC. Oh, one last warning. Of course, we're talking to comedians about doing comedy, and yes, certain language comes with it, you know what I mean? So maybe don't listen with someone you wouldn't bring to a comedy club. Okay, welcome all of you to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Kyle, Kasia, you both started your lives in science. Let me ask you, Kyle, how did stand-up comedy enter the mix?
That's a great question. I actually never thought of myself as a creative person, even when I was doing research. But sometime in the middle of my PhD program, I discovered stand-up in the UK. I think for me, I'm so used to talking about science on like the product end of it. You know, you've gone through the research, telling people what you found, you know, but I'd never felt free to talk about what that process actually looks like, that it's messy, that, you know, you have to go through internal politics sometimes. And being able to do that with stand-up comedy was completely liberating, because then I could really talk and share what life was like as a scientist.
That's really interesting. And Kasia, how did your comedy get mixed in with your science?
So I decided to do stand-up comedy because I thought it'd be something surprising for me to do. I thought people wouldn't expect like this, you know, lanky, tall Indian girl who looks very studious to go up there and try and do some jokes. To me, science was all around me. I grew up in this household with physicians, and it made sense to me to make jokes about science. So I started doing that. And then I realized, even though I was in Boston, people did not like those. One, because I was terrible at stand-up. So everyone is terrible when they first start something, but it's so egregious in stand-up comedy. Then I moved to Washington, D.C. People at my work, which was NASA at that time, found out that I did stand-up comedy. They asked me, hey, do you do jokes about science? And I said, you would come to a stand-up comedy show about science? And they said, yes. And I put it on, and then more people kept coming, and that's how my science comedy career got started.
Oh, that's amazing. Chuck, I put the same question to you, although I know you have kind of a different story because you've been in comedy for many years.
Yeah, so the science did not come first. I came to stand-up comedy the traditional route, where I started with a scarred childhood and then developed a drinking problem. And
I wish I had a rim shot here somewhere.
But really, I've always been a closeted geek, nerd. I've always been a person who read scientific materials and admired science and the scientific method. And I think that stand-up comedy and science have very much in common in that respect. Because, you know, when you think about it, you know, we normally start with an observation or a question. We don't really then research it, but we do formulate a hypothesis about that observation. The experimentation is the joke itself, seeing whether or not it will get a laugh. And there's only one way you can figure out if a joke is going to get a laugh, and that is you have to tell it in front of an audience. And then after that, you go, wow, that sucked. I can't believe that wasn't funny, because I really thought it was. So then what you do is you have to repeat that entire process to figure out why it wasn't funny. So the similarities are really striking. And for me, working with Neil and Star Talk, which is our podcast, and people thought, oh, wow, you really know your stuff, thinking like, oh, wow, you just know it. No. You know, we would have scientists on the show, and I have to go read their work.
Oh, details, details.
From that, that exposure basically made it so that it was very easy for me.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go play some of your clips, because they're really funny. We have some of them here. And Chuck, here's one of your jokes about climate change. And I want you to listen to it. We'll all listen to it. And when I come back, I want you to tell us why this is such a good joke.
I really admire people who take personal steps to mitigate their carbon footprint. However, I have to admit, whenever I see like a grown man in Manhattan going to work in a suit on a skateboard, I can't help but think to myself, is that a socially responsible eco-warrior? Or just some dude with 5 DUIs? And it's kind of hard to know the difference. Because on the outside, it looks the same, you know? On the outside, it's just like, I'm a socially responsible eco-warrior lowering my carbon footprint by going to work on a skateboard. And on the inside, it could be like, this is bullshit. I used to have a car and a girlfriend.
Oh, that's a great joke, Chuck.
Thank you.
How did you decide that would be a joke and then craft it?
That joke came out of, I remember specifically, a conversation with someone who was very upset with the self-righteous nature of people who think they're so doggone special because they're saving the planet. And so from that, I was like, wow, this guy's really angry. Like, where does that anger come from? And then I started thinking about it, and I thought about, oh, you know, the anger comes from the fact that there are people who are demonstrably concerned about this issue. And they will let you know that you ought to be concerned too. And that upsets people for some reason. And I started trying to think about how do I convey that? But I wanted to convey it in a way where you get the message, but it's silly. And a guy on a skateboard in a 3-piece suit going to work in Manhattan, which I have seen.
He's probably a finance bro, so, you know.
He probably is a finance bro. I was like, that's the imagery. That's it right there. Because if you've been in New York, you've probably seen that. And, you know, you could say, oh, that's a guy who's wanting to save the planet.
Right.
Or just a guy with 5 DUIs.
That's cool. Well, let's talk about, you know, scientists like to deconstruct things. So let's deconstruct the joke. What makes a good joke, Kyle? Walk me through the process of writing a new joke. I'm in the writer's room. What does it look like?
Totally. There is such a thing as a writer's room, although a lot of stand-ups don't necessarily have that benefit. So like, you know, sketch rooms, you know, writing for late night TV, you get writer's rooms and bounce ideas with other people. But the process for a stand-up is totally solo for the most part. And so, you know, sometimes some of us, like me, for example, I like to start with, you know, a story, like, what do I find funny about something that happened to me? But some stand-ups are just like, you know, set a punchline, laughs per minute. And I think that's what's so great about the process is like, everybody has a different process. But to go from the start, the middle is always the same. We need to bring it to people. We need to understand that like, hey, this setup is too long for this audience. They are impatient. They are drunk. They don't want to have to think about what's funny. So I need to let go of some stuff. People paid to laugh. And, you know, the craft and like the comedian in me is like, okay, how much do I need to cut? And then there's a scientist in me and like the educator in me who's like, okay, how much can I buy time for so I can set up like sort of how I think and get them to think the way that I do so that they're laughing the way that I would at this joke.
Kasia, are there any topics that are off limits that are harder to write jokes about? I mean, you've got physics, climate change, your research methodology, statistics. What do you say to, do you have to put stuff off the table that you can't tell a joke about?
I think you just have to be creative in how you tell the joke. It's all about how you package it. Climate change, in my experience, in terms of scientific topics, is one of the harder topics to make jokes about. I've tried it. It just bums people out as soon as they hear the word climate change. And also, there's a lot of other stuff connected to those words. It's a lot of political beliefs attached to it. And even if you're just talking about something that's just the science, which is what I want to focus on, you still have to address the other things. But like I said, it's all about how you package it for an audience. So I don't think there's anything necessarily off limits in science. It's just they have to be really funny, extra tight, and you have to find the right angle.
Well, Chuck, if there's nothing off limits, then you have to assume that the audience is at least fluent in science to get the joke.
No, because your job is to bring the commonality of the room together. So, you know, wherever that common thread is sewn through us all, that's what you want to do with comedy. So if you're, let's say you're talking about, you know, not everybody's married, but, you know, most married comedians do jokes about marriage. They don't assume that people have to be married to get these jokes. And not everybody has children, but every comic with children does jokes about children. They don't assume you have to be a parent in order to get the jokes. The idea is to make it so that you find the identifiable commonalities in the subject matter so that everyone can relate to it.
In case you're just joining us, this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. We're talking about the comedy of science with comedians Kasia Patel, Chuck Nice, and Kyle Marin-Viterbo. Oh, well, let me ask Kasia, because I watched your special, and you were doing a whole special about the oceans, right? And my question to you is then, is the purpose of the joke or the special about the oceans, is it to sneakily give people information that they won't normally get, but you put it in a joke wrapper and they get it, or is it something else?
For me, my personal motivation is to sneak the science into my regular stand-up because I found that in order to sustain my science comedy shows, I need to practice the jokes. And as Chuck said, the only way to practice it is in front of as many people as you can. And unfortunately, I don't get to perform for scientists every day at 10 p.m. On a Tuesday. But, you know, I just try and bring them in, dangle a carrot, they kind of sniff that, and then bring them in and surprise them with something that they can learn.
Well, let's bring, I have a clip from one of your shows this year at a show in New York in the fall, and you were talking about your wedding, and you turned it into a lesson on neuroscience. Let's listen to that.
I was explaining how beautiful it was to my friend who couldn't make it because I didn't invite her. And I was saying, like, you know, I want to remember this day forever. And she, who is a neuroscientist, told me that actually, every time you recall a memory, you risk the chance of manipulating it, and it gets further away from the reality that it actually was. And I thought about it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I think she's right. Because I remember her being way more pleasant when we first met.
I love that joke so much. That was good.
That is a great joke. How long does it take to write a joke like that?
Well, I just got married in July, and I was just trying to write anything new. And the only thing I could think about was I'm married and I have this wedding. And, you know, it's what Chuck said. People, not everyone's married, but you do married jokes. So I was trying out my wedding jokes. They weren't really hitting as well. And then I was thinking about memories. Right. Everyone always, they know these facts about memories. And the funny thing is, when I say the part where my neuroscientist friend said, every time you recall a memory, you risk the chance of losing it and manipulating it, every time I did that joke, people in the crowd nodded their head yes, or like poked their friend and was like, that's true. And that actually doesn't happen with too many of my jokes, where all these non-sciencey people are like, that's right. And they can actually fact check it in real time. And then the ending of it, I was like, okay, what's a creative way to end this? And I thought just making it a little meta and bringing it back to the joke of what she's saying, bring it back onto itself.
I think one of my favorite things, especially with that joke, Kasia, like, is that, you know, you don't need to know who in the room is a science aficionado or has read enough about memories and neuroscience. Like, the thing that makes people laugh the hardest is that we're all thinking it. And, like, that's the funniest part about it, because like Kasha got to tell what the process of like memory making is. But the thing that made people laugh so hard was the fact that we said out loud the thing that we're not allowed to say to somebody's face, which was like, okay, you were nicer way before, you know, and that's kind of how we all get to laugh at it. But hey, you learned something along the way, and you're not going to forget it because you laughed real hard, maybe a little too hard. Okay.
I mean, that's the hope, right? Like, I've had people come up to me after a set, show their phone saying, hey, that study you talked about is actually real. And I was like, yeah, all my premises are true. I'm not making up science here. But it's cool that I inspired them enough to remember it and Google it later.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from science comedians Kasha Patel, Kyle Marin-Viterbo, and Chuck Nice after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking science comedy this hour, and this is comedian Sammy Obaid performing one of his many science-themed jokes.
I trip and I fall all the time. Gravity and I have an abusive relationship. Like, I'll show up to my friends with, like, bruises and scars. They're like, Sammy, did gravity do that to you? Come on, it's cool. They're like, Sammy, did gravity do that to you? I'm like, yeah, but you don't know gravity like I do. You know what I mean? He keeps me grounded and down to earth. He just follows me everywhere I go, you know? How hard does he hit you, Sammy? How hard does he hit you? 9.8 meters per second squared.
We've been talking about how science can be a subject of comedy and how comedy can be a science communication tool with my guests, comedians Kyle Marin-Viterbo, Chuck Nice, and Kasha Patel. Well, we know that comedy is an art form known for pushing boundaries of what's acceptable to talk about. Like, you hear us bleeping some swear words there. And do you see that famous boundary pushing happening in your science-adjacent jokes, too? Are they just as vulnerable to those boundaries, Chuck?
Yes. A big chunk of my show right now is about science literacy, being scientifically literate, and more importantly, how America is becoming anti-science. Now, I won't say that we're actually becoming anti-science. I will say that for some reason, we're embracing it more readily. And of course, that brings up all this politics and people feel this tension and, you know, they know what I'm talking about and they know who I'm talking about when I do that. And you will be surprised how many people get upset because I'm saying that we should resist being anti-science, you know. However, if I were to look at things scientifically, I would say it makes perfect sense that we are anti-science because the human brain does not work, if you think about empirical data being a measure of information, that's a very recent occurrence in human evolution. That is not something that, you know, mostly what we looked for as our human brain is patterns. So it makes sense that we're kind of anti-science, but not really in the greatest technologically advanced nation in the world, which is what we're supposed to be, when really you find out we're just kind of masquerading as, you know, stupid people with really great toys.
Chuck, you more than me, you have toured a lot across the country.
Yes.
With stand-up. And we sell shows to science shows. People buy into it. They know what they're buying into. But when we do our science jokes at regular comedy clubs,
right,
the times where it like falls flat or we lose the room, we feel it. Like, people don't have to heckle and like yell back at us, which has happened. And that's the thing that really drives it into me when I'm doing stand-up and, like, bringing in the science is, like, okay, I can't get it. I can't get them to laugh about science. But, like, it then becomes, like, that driving force behind me to be, like, okay, how am I going to get them to laugh about the science? Okay, this audience isn't into it. If I talk about anti-science or, you know, anti-vaccination, like, how am I going to get them on my side? And then I work on that, you know?
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, if I can say something along those same lines. So I wanted to know, so like I said earlier, I do science jokes, but I do non-science jokes as well. And then for my TEDx talk that I did, I analyzed 500 of my jokes. I classified them as science and non-science jokes. And I found out that my science jokes actually did better than my non-science jokes. And this was told probably primarily to non-science audiences because I perform, you know, 4 to 11 times a week. Like, most of the time, those aren't science shows, right? So to me, it was interesting that this is like what the great gift of comedy is, that if you are able to hit it right, like Ira, you asked me, you know, is there a topic in science that's off limits? No, I mean, if you are able to figure out that angle, like Chuck's joke, I think was so great because the three-piece suit on the skateboard, I'm in DC, I don't need to be in Manhattan. We have that version here, they're on scooters. And then you make it, it's all about the diversion where it's like, oh, this person looks very socially, you know, very green, but then what's the surprising other explanation for it? Like the way it's crafted like a regular joke, just like with science terms in there. And I think that the audience, non-scientists, want that. They just don't know that they want it. And that's why it's up to us to use comedy, in my opinion, to like sneak it in there. Spring it on them.
Speaking of scientists and non-scientists, it occurred to me while you were talking that there were a lot of scientists who were very angry at the TV show The Big Bang Theory because they thought they were making fun of scientists, when in fact, if you looked at the actual science they were talking about, it was real, right?
Well, I think a lot of comedy writers also did not like that comedy show. So everyone just kind of hated that show that it was represented in there, I suppose.
No, the audience loved it.
Right.
They did. And they did. However, yeah. I will say the one benefit that the show did have culturally was that it made embracing science, science literacy, the professions that they all held, all of those things became far more acceptable and even somewhat glamorous because they're being glorified on television. And I thought that that was a good thing.
One thing I would like to add too is like with comedy, any form of comedy, whether it's like sketch, stand-up, whatever, our audiences have to give us permission to misbehave. And that's what makes it funny because we're talking about like human failures and like why it's so weird to be a human being. And I think sometimes we do get this pushback from, you know, scientists, from organizations that like using humor and comedy is a no-no because it doesn't look good for the PR of scientists. You know, like you're pushing people's, you know, understanding of like what's okay to say as a scientist, as a comedian. And like, if you don't frame it perfectly, then you fail. And like a huge part of both science and stand-up is that you have to keep failing to figure out how to say it the best way.
So speaking of saying the best way, I want to play a clip of yours, Kyle, from one of your recent performances in which you go out of your way to challenge the historic lack of diversity in who gets to be a scientist. Let's hear that now.
I'm a former scientist, and I feel like there's always a hero story whenever someone's like, I'm a scientist, listen to me. But it's interesting because my hero story starts in the Philippines. I don't know if you guys know this, but in the Philippines, we consume a lot of American media. And I was watching something and I fell in love with science because I fell in love with Indiana Jones. So hot. But what was funny too is like, okay, cut to a few years later, you know, our parents decide to bring us to New York City, we immigrate, and I realize I can finally follow the American dream, become a white man. Who has tenure? Can f*** off in the middle of lectures, go to a developing nation, steal something from indigenous peoples and say that belongs in a museum. But it's not stealing. White people, am I right?
That's brilliant, brilliant.
That is, wow. You hit all the notes. That was amazing. That was great.
And it's crazy because it's like, you know, I just read a story about how like, you know, archaeologists were taking stuff from like Mexico. And there was just, I mean, there's just like such, it's a fight that's still going on.
Yes.
Well, Kyle, did you feel and do you feel that's part of your goal as a comedian to help keep these things in view?
I mean, this is why I gravitated towards stand-up. And it was at a time when I was like, you know, feeling really burnt out by being a paleoanthropologist. But the fact that I'm Filipino, I wanted to study human evolution in island Southeast Asia. And the permissions I had to get from Western museums, from all of these, you know, white men in power, to get a chance to study and look at fossils about, you know, and really understand what it meant to be, you know, from island Southeast Asia where humans came from, like, you know, all of these museums that still hold power over these things and like have first rights to study these things. Like, these were things that were at the back of my head and kind of nagging me even as I was doing my research. But I never had the courage to talk about it openly until I found stand-up. I just feel like there's, for me, power in being able to actually speak that out loud. Like, one of my proudest moments is hosting a comedy show, you know, about how museums are not neutral spaces. And to actually host it with a bunch of museum people in the audience, many of whom were uncomfortable, but I had the few people who were people of color come up to me laughing so hard at how uncomfortable everybody was. Like, you know, if a regular stand-up saw that, they would have thought I bombed. But the fact that they were really uncomfortable, that they were part of, you know, a systemic issue, like that felt so good.
Kasia, you're involved with NASA. How does your stand-up comedy connect to the more straightforward, serious work that you do?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's so interesting. I always like talking to Chuck and Kyle because I think all three of us, every science comedian I meet, has kind of a different perspective on what they want their science comedy to mean. Kyle is very targeted. I think it's extremely important. I try and go for like science. I just try and go for like the broadest brush that I can get, right? So for NASA, everyone loves space. So I just try and educate them. Like, when I worked at NASA, I have a lot of jokes about what it's like to work at NASA because people always ask me that. And I have a joke about how it was really hard working there because everyone loves NASA more than any other government agency. Like, I've never seen someone walking around with a shirt that said IRS because they liked what they did in the 60s. So in that same regard, so my science comedy is more of just trying to get the broadest brush and communicate scientific findings. Earlier, Kyle said that, you know, some stand-up comedians are more premise punchline, and that's what I would classify myself as, where I sift through scientific studies. I'll like write a headline almost. That's like how it kind of relates to my journalism. Mm. I think of the premise right. as the headline of an article. It just has the bare minimum of what you need to understand it. And then I'll write like a 1 to 2 sentence punchline right after that.
Chuck, I've got a wild card question for you.
Go right ahead.
Ukraine's President Zelensky is a comedian turned politician, right?
That's right.
Well, as a comedian who knows comedians, are you surprised that he turned out to be such a charismatic leader?
Not at all. One of the things that being a comedian is most about, and Kyle touched on it without saying it this way, is that what we do is we hold up a mirror to society. And sometimes people don't like what they see in that mirror. And if that's the case, then we're considered being a person who speaks truth to power. And then sometimes people identify with that mirror, and then we're considered the comedian who has their finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist. But the truth is, we're doing the same thing no matter what. We're just holding up this mirror so that people can take an honest look at themselves, because that is really what it's about. Authenticity and honesty in the reflection of society through our particular gaze.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios, talking about the comedy of science. We've got one more joke for you. This is comedian Ronnie Chang talking about encountering COVID-19 deniers on the internet.
All right, like, this is the miraculous technological era that we live in right now. Okay, within 3 months, in March 2020, they decoded the genome of the virus. Yeah, they decoded it. You're like, yo, everyone, look, we found it. We found the enemy. Everybody, look, we got it right here. Look, it's A-A-A-B-B-B-B-B-G-G-G-G-G-A-D-D-D-D-D-D-A-C-C-C-C-C-C-T. Can you imagine showing that to these idiots on Facebook? Demanding evidence? So what's the evidence? Is that evidence? Is that right here? Yeah, we got it. We found the exact sequence of proteins and amino acids. The f*** is this shit? Oh, yeah, right. You decoded a genome.
What about scientists? Is the takeaway that everyone, especially scientists, should just be funnier when they talk about their research? Is this a takeaway message? Does the world need funny scientists?
You don't have to be funnier to be hilarious. It's a skill set, right? Like the fact that, you know, anyone can start something, anyone can start a craft, anyone can start a little bit of stand-up, but it's a long-term skill set in playing with communicating and connecting with your audience. And so I think, you know, I've trained up academics and scientists to add a little humor to their work, but, you know, it's something that gives us the flexibility and to be able to really listen to our audience, which, you know, these days we need more of.
Katya?
Yeah, that's a great question. Stand-up comedy is hard. Like Kyle said, it is a skill set that you have to hone. I actually just recently published a study with some other science, like real PhD science people, that's what they're called. And we did a bunch of my science jokes, and we had a bunch of different comedians say them in front of an audience, and they were either labeled as a scientist or comedian for one of the scenarios. And we found out that people thought that if the joke wasn't that funny, they thought that the scientist was a less effective communicator than the comedian, which is a little bit surprising. To me, I took that to mean that people have the stereotype of what scientists are, that if you try and be funny and you don't make it, the repercussions for that are a lot harder than if you're labeled as a comedian. And I think what the stand-up comedy teaches us, like Kyle's a good example where she talks about what it's like to be a scientist. And you mentioned scientists hate Big Bang Theory. Well, the reason they don't like Big Bang Theory is because it's all science stereotypes. It's scientists who are nerds. They can't communicate well. And I think all three of us show that you can talk about science in a fun and engaging way. And I'm not saying that scientists need to be funny and be cracking punchlines, but I think tapping into more of their personality, the basis for good stand-up comedy is also the basis for good communication in general.
Well, I got to say, I think this was the funniest segment we've done in 31 years on Science Friday. And I want to...
Wow. That's funny
there. Notice how we all laugh.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We're like, you should really come to our shows. You'd be a great audience.
You're laughing with us, not at us, I'm hoping.
Absolutely.
So. Kasia Patel, yes. Chuck Nice, and our own Kyle Marin Verturbo, thank you very much all for taking time to be with us today.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You can find links to more of their work, plus other great comics. It's up there on our website, sciencefriday.com/comedy. Oh, one last thing before we go. I want to bid a teary goodbye to sci-fi producer Christy Taylor. Christy has been an important part of our show in so many ways, from her incisive and well-reasoned viewpoints to her unending search for how science and the arts connect, to the gentle tutoring she gave me on some very sensitive subjects. Christy's knowledge, good humor, and stories about her days in roller derby will be sorely missed. We wish her all the best in her next endeavor, and Christy, please stay in touch. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a Florida team looks for clues to how gophers feed themselves. It is the mystery of the underground root farm. You're not going to want to miss that. But first, redlining. The practice was pervasive in American cities beginning in the 1930s through the late 60s. Maps were drawn specifically to ensure that black people were denied mortgages. And these discriminatory practices created a lasting legacy of economic and racial inequality, which still persists today. Less obvious, though, is how redlining has shaped nature, the urban ecosystem. A recent study found that previously redlined neighborhoods in Baltimore have fewer big old trees and less tree diversity. These findings are part of the Baltimore Ecosystem Study, a collaborative research project which has tracked the city's changing urban environment for the last 25 years. But it's not all bad news. The city of Baltimore has a comprehensive tree replanting initiative and is working with the community to restore the tree canopy. Joining me now to talk more about the trees and her research is Karen Burkhardt, Assistant Professor of Entomology at the University of Maryland, based in College Park, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Let's talk about your research. Tell me how the trees in redline neighborhoods compared to trees in other neighborhoods in Baltimore.
Yeah, so first, if we're looking at the overall number of trees, we find 25 to 35% fewer species of trees for the same number of trees that we're looking across. So basically, you are getting about a third fewer species in neighborhoods that were previously redlined.
Now, is that an important difference?
It is important. So these trees are doing a lot for folks in the city. They are providing shade. They are providing habitat for all kinds of critters that use these, birds, insects. And they also can provide the ability to mitigate storm runoff. And when we have fewer species in a given area, we are more likely to lose those particular individuals. Kind of like a mutual fund, if you have a lot of different species that are in a particular community, then when we have pests that come through or other diseases, think about emerald ash borer or Dutch elm disease. If everything in a given neighborhood is the same species, then we're going to lose all of those individuals all at once.
So why has this disparity in the number and the types of trees between the previously redlined neighborhoods and other parts of the city, why has that continued for so many decades?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say for sure. This is a correlational study, so we're not able to say that the reason we're seeing fewer trees is explicitly because of this policy. But there's all kinds of things that these policies represent. Most importantly, they represent the investment of time and resources on the part of a city. So when we have policy decisions that are made that decrease home values in a particular area, then it's probably more likely that there will be less investment in maintaining street trees, which represent a lot of time and effort to keep healthy. Then over time, you could see this impact on the overall diversity of trees and the number of trees. So another thing we found is that you're 9 times less likely to find a large old tree in a potential location in one of these previously redlined neighborhoods.
Wow. And big trees also help the young trees to survive too, don't they?
It's much harder to establish trees in an area that has very low canopy cover. And in these redlined neighborhoods, we tend to have lower tree canopy cover on average. And when that happens, you have higher temperatures. And those higher temperatures can make the conditions much more challenging for a young tree that's planted to kind of get their leg up and grow to maturity.
Now, the good news, the city has a campaign working with local community groups to replant trees, right? Which we're going to talk about in a bit. How will this research help the city reach its tree planting goals in the future?
We saw this really interesting increase in the number of small trees that were being planted in previously redlined areas. So we get this really clear signature that the city is reinvesting, but we do have the overuse or dominance of single species. We're getting a lot of planting of red maple specifically. So that kind of raises a little bit of a red flag that maybe we need to use studies like this to make sure that we are targeting our diversity goals in these previously redlined areas so that they are going to be able to withstand pests and other diseases in the future and grow these canopies that can provide services for residents.
Very interesting. What can other cities learn from your research, cities besides Baltimore?
So in Baltimore, we have red maple that is kind of the dominant species, but a lot of other researchers have found kind of similar reliance on single species in other cities. I also want to point out that 239 other cities in the U.S. were redlined as well. And so this happened in many different cities. And so as they're planning these replanting campaigns, thinking about the legacy of these policies, how that might affect the potential survival of trees in these different neighborhoods, could be useful for them as a framework for making decisions about replantings there.
Well, Dr. Burkhardt, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Karen Burkhardt, Assistant Professor of Entomology at the University of Maryland, based in College Park. Now that we've identified some of the problems facing Baltimore's tree canopy, I want to turn to some solutions. In 2007, the city of Baltimore set a goal to increase the tree cover from 20 to 40% by 2037. And since then, the city has been working closely with nonprofit community organizations to plant trees all over the city, especially in previously redlined and otherwise underserved neighborhoods. The nonprofit Baltimore Tree Trust has the biggest footprint in the city. They've planted over 16,000 trees so far. Joining me now to tell us more about the organization's work is my guest, Ryan Alston, Communications and Outreach Manager for Baltimore Tree Trust, based in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. This ambitious effort to restore Baltimore's trees is a collaboration with community members. How do you work with communities to identify where and when the trees will be planted?
Absolutely. So kind of what you spoke about earlier with Baltimore being the kind of blueprint for redlining, we here at the Tree Trust really acknowledge that. And we have the opportunity to really flip that and give communities and residents a voice when historically they've kind of been forgotten about and haven't had that input. And so when we're planning for our trees, we're meeting with residents in their neighborhoods, in their communities, and giving them a chance to let us know what their needs really are.
That's interesting, because there was a study that came out in 2019 showing that Detroit residents didn't want these free trees provided by the city because they were not consulted in the process. There was a deep mistrust between the city's Black residents and the mostly white nonprofits overseeing the tree planting. Is there some trust that needs to be rebuilt between local nonprofits and community members in Baltimore, too?
Absolutely. I mean, we all have a running joke at Baltimore Tree Trust that building tree trust is really in our name. It is kind of the foreground of a lot of the work that we're doing. When we're meeting with residents and having those conversations, definitely understanding that every experience is valid and everyone is going to have a different experience with trees and with city workers and city development. But it's really our job to connect with residents on that one-on-one basis and really listen.
How do you do that? Do you go right out there into the neighborhoods and talk with people?
Right before our season starts, we're working to identify community leaders. These are residents who've been in their homes. They've seen the changes that has occurred throughout the years. And so we're using that as a launch pad to start these conversations. These stakeholders are able to connect us to different neighborhood associations or friends of groups or school leaders. We're able to really branch off of these connections from these long-standing community members and people who are really invested in seeing good change in their neighborhoods.
When you talk to people, do they understand how important trees are to their neighborhoods? I understand summer is the best time to sell the benefits of trees to residents because of the heat, right?
Absolutely. That's definitely one of the selling points. You know, we're walking with community leaders and residents around their neighborhoods and having that ability to say, this block is 12 to 15 degrees warmer in the summertime based on communities that have a lot more trees. That's also part of our job, is to get them to understand why trees, specifically in urban spaces and urban neighborhoods, are so important. We're planting shade. We're planting trees that are going to help clear the air quality. And that always gets residents to start thinking about trees as something more than just an arbitrary planting, but something that can really be part of the neighborhood infrastructure and this city infrastructure.
I understand that one of the issues facing Baltimore's tree canopy is that there are too many red maples and the lack of tree species diversity. How do you select which types of trees are going to plant?
Yeah, so one of our founding statements, I think, at the Tree Trust is right tree, right place, right? We're understanding that, you know, there are different tree species that are going to do well in urban areas. So we work off of a palette of a few species that are proven to survive in urban settings, and specifically their native species. But of course, with climate change, and we're seeing changes in temperatures and precipitation, that's causing us to think a little bit more and switch our gears about the trees that we're planting. So switching more to some southern species that are able to survive in more of the warmer temperatures and in a bit more of a drought, and really keeping in mind that tree diversity is important.
Hmm. What advice would you give other cities who are working to replant trees?
I think definitely one piece of advice is that community outreach piece and engaging residents at every level of tree planting. So we're giving residents the ability to have some input in the planting plans. We're giving them input in allowing them to come join us for a planting day. And we're also educating them on how to maintain and care for these trees long after we're gone.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you, to that great city of Baltimore.
Thank you so much.
Ryan Alston, Communications and Outreach Manager for Baltimore Tree Trust, based, of course, in Baltimore, Maryland. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, digging for diet details about an unappreciated burrower, pocket gophers. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you cozy with a book or movie over the winter holidays? Maybe, as seems to be very popular right now, an intriguing whodunit. Well, we're back with a different kind of mystery, and it's all about gophers. Yes, there is a mystery about gophers. Here on the case is sci-fi sleuth Christy Taylor. Hey there, Christy.
Hey there, Ira.
You know what comes to mind when I think about gophers? Not a mystery, but that crazy gopher-filled movie, Caddyshack, you know what I mean?
That's fair. A little slapstick, but
yeah,
it makes sense when you think of how these animals have been considered pests by so many people. But they're also really impressive little animals, Ira. Their tunnel networks are absolutely massive, even for just one gopher, which is good for aerating soil. Ecologists consider them really important ecosystem engineers.
Yes, we like ecosystem engineers.
Yeah, we do. And gophers are also mysterious. We don't know much about them because they almost never leave those tunnels, not even to eat.
Well, wait a minute. If they don't leave, then what do they eat? How do they eat?
That's the million-dollar question, Ira. The leading theory has long been that they simply eat roots while they dig tunnels. Need more roots? Dig another tunnel. But a team at the University of Florida looked into that, and they're now questioning whether there's more to the story. Their work was published in Current Biology this summer. I talked to Veronica Selden. She was an undergraduate when she did this project, and it was her idea in the first place. I also talked to her advisor, biology professor Dr. Jack Putz. Here's Veronica explaining why she started looking at gophers, also known as pocket gophers, more closely.
Pocket gophers are fossorial rodents. They spend nearly their entire lives excavating underground tunnel networks. And that excavation is an energetically costly activity. But in terms of length, the tunnel systems can extend up to 160 meters long.
Wow.
I was intrigued by the question of how they obtain enough food to sustain that activity. And we also wondered why they would invest so much energy into excavating and maintaining and defending such extensive tunnel systems when they're solitary animals and theoretically don't need that amount of space.
How do you go about figuring out then how much energy it takes to dig out a tunnel like that?
We found and excavated into pocket gopher tunnels and took measurements of the tunnel radius and took soil samples from adjacent to the tunnel. And with that, we were able to calculate the soil bulk density. And using the dimensions of the tunnel, we were able to calculate, using a pre-existing equation, how much energy it would take to excavate a tunnel of a certain volume.
Jack, as her advisor, as Veronica's advisor, what made you interested in this question about pocket gophers and the energy they consume, or the energy that they need to do what they do?
These are animals that are common in many places. You see their mounds, but you very seldom see them. I mean, anything that's spending its life below ground is just intriguing. And when we first went out to excavate a tunnel, we really had no idea what we were doing. And we were surprised at how deep we had to go before actually encountering a tunnel. And we noticed that at that depth, there are very few roots. So they're down below the volume of soil with dense roots. And so it made us think about, well, where are they getting their food if there's so few roots down there? When they come to the surface to move out the material that they excavate from their tunnels, they're, you know, subjected to predators, birds and snakes, and everything else eats pocket gophers. So they want to stay down low, but there's not much food down there.
So at the end of the day, you dug out the tunnels, you did the math. Veronica, are they getting enough food from the roots that they eat when they're excavating these tunnels?
We found that on average, they are not getting enough energy from excavation to sustain that excavation. There is an energy deficit there.
Mm-hmm. How big is the deficit?
On average, 9 kilojoules. So they're using 9 kilojoules more than they're gaining.
Mm-hmm. So how do we explain then, they're digging their tunnel, they're chomping roots while they dig the tunnel, and that's not providing enough food for them. How do we begin to explain then where they're getting the rest of the energy they need to stay alive?
We knew that roots would grow into sewer systems, a situation similar to a pocket gopher tunnel. So we looked into whether roots would grow into the gopher tunnels and perhaps if that could sustain their lifestyle. So to test that, we isolated sections of tunnel, preventing gophers from entering by blocking all sides. Before the isolation period, we confirmed that there were no roots visible in the tunnel by filming inside with a borescope. After the period of isolation, we filmed inside the tunnel again, and we were greeted with a vision of many roots growing into the tunnel. And we found that on average, this root ingrowth, daily root ingrowth, can account for 21% of their daily basal energetic needs. That's obviously not covering the entirety of their needs. So there is still an unsolved question of where are they getting the rest of their energy? But it does paint a more complete picture of how they're sustaining themselves.
They're not just eating the roots once when they dig out the tunnel, but also more roots will grow into the tunnel for them to sort of snack on as they're going about their days.
Yes.
Jack and Veronica, you also in your paper suggest that this behavior could be considered farming by the gophers. They're creating conditions that allow these roots, their food, to grow better than it might otherwise. Do you other biologists agree with this definition?
That's been so interesting to see the range of reactions that basically go back to how you define farming. Some people restrict farming to annual cropping of grains, but there's other kinds of farming that I would consider legitimate uses of that term, where people who live in forested ecosystems farm forests by promoting the growth of trees and vines and shrubs that they then harvest. In the case of pocket gophers, they're, as you said, they're creating conditions appropriate for the growth of roots, that favor the growth of roots, and then they're cropping those roots. And actually, in the cropping process, they may be stimulating the production of new roots, and new roots that are more digestible than the ones that they excavated. So because they're younger and they'd be more succulent. And so that together, for me and for about half the people who have contacted us, that does constitute a form of farming. But what's exciting is to think about an animal that's accepted as an ecosystem engineer. I mean, they are turning over soil, they are having a big effect on the ecosystem. But considering that animal is actively farming roots, I just find exciting.
Veronica, how are you feeling about this research? You got it published before you'd even finished your undergraduate. I mean, that must be exciting.
That was definitely very exciting. I enjoyed so much getting to learn about these gophers. As Jack said, they are considered ecosystem engineers. I hope that even if we don't sufficiently convince everybody that they are farming, we can at least promote appreciation for the complex life cycles of these little animals underground.
What kind of research would maybe further clarify what's going on with what they're eating?
I would like to see people doing more detailed work that would allow assessment of what roots are they preferring. We knew which species there were above ground, but not which species they're eating. We also don't know whether other fossorial mammals like pocket gophers are doing something that's very similar, but we suspect that they are. And almost everywhere in the world, there's an animal like this. But as far as I'm aware, no one has studied this aspect of their natural history. Having cameras, getting ideas of activity cycles, and we don't know, for example, why they're digging, when they're digging, whether the amount of tunnel excavation varies seasonally. Yeah, there's so many mysteries about these animals. It's just hard to study an animal that is below ground, especially that far below ground. But I think there's a lot of research that could be done and should be done. We hope that this project stimulates that kind of activity.
Thank you both so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you again for having us.
That was Veronica Selden and the University of Florida's Dr. Jack Putz. Their research on pocket gophers appeared in Current Biology in July. I'm Christy Taylor.
You've probably seen, or maybe you're even using, an activated carbon filter or two. That's the filter in your water pitcher that you probably should change more often than you actually do. It's also that black filter in your air purifier, removing chemicals from the air. These are activated carbon filters, and they aren't just in your home. They're used in wastewater treatment and smokestacks. But what if we could create these filters using recycled materials? My next guest is working on this. She's so far made activated carbon filters from agricultural waste, meaning corn husks and orange peels. Joining me now to talk more about her research is Dr. Candace Abdul-Aziz, Assistant Professor of Chemical and Environmental Engineering at UC Riverside, that's based in Riverside, California. Dr. Abdul-Aziz, welcome to Science Friday.
All right. Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
As I mentioned before, you turn husks and stalks and leaves into carbon filters. How did you land on corn waste?
Yeah, so corn waste is actually the top agricultural waste that's produced from the United States. I went to school in University of Illinois, so I'm very familiar with all of the corn fields around. And so that was one of the first initial problems that we wanted to utilize, was to see if we can do something with all of the corn waste that's generated.
And how do you turn corn husks into carbon filters? I know if you put a match to a corn husk, it's going to start burning and turning black, but that's not what you do, is it?
No. So my laboratory at UC Riverside, we've actually developed a process that can break down corn husk and even citrus peels into solid carbon. And so what we do is we do some chemical modification of that solid carbon and creates this porous structure, which is then called activated carbon. And you can utilize activated carbon in all of these different cool applications.
Now, let's talk about some of those cool applications. Name a few really good ones for us.
Sure. So one of the ones that people are most familiar with is water filtration. In fact, my laboratory has been studying how we can modify activated carbon filters from agricultural waste and utilize that to remove different water pollutants. Another way also is for air purification. So you can use activated carbon filters, say in your car, to purify the air that's going while you're driving your vehicle.
Now, I understand that you can actually filter out PFAS, which is everywhere, right?
When we first started working on the development of these activated carbon water filters, we were looking at the removal of different phenolic compounds, because those are typically what you see from industrial waste. But we talked with some people at water municipalities, especially in Southern California, where we're located, and PFAS seemed to be one of the things that were on a lot of these municipalities' minds in terms of removing that from wastewater. And so we've recently started looking at the removal of PFAS from wastewater, and in terms of trying to modify also the activated carbon properties so that we can do that effectively as well.
You mentioned that you were turning orange peels into carbon filters using a similar process. I would imagine that being California, all those orange groves, that's where you get your peels from, right?
Yes. Absolutely. So just around the corner from my house, we have an orange grove. And we had the idea of we're in Southern California and we want to benefit the local industry here as well. And so we wanted to turn those orange peels, which are normally discarded or used for cow feed, and see if we can also utilize that for activated carbon. And actually, one of my doctoral students just went to the citrus grove that's around the corner from my house and got like a trash bag full of orange peels. And we've been utilizing that for a lot of our experiments.
They must have been more than happy to give it to you.
Yeah, they were very happy.
What are activated carbon filters typically made from, and why should we be using recycled ones, coming up with new materials like you are, like corn husks or orange peels instead?
Typically, activated carbon is usually made from either coal or coconuts. Now, coal, I mean, if we're trying to get away from coal as a energy resource, then it would be more advantageous for us to utilize something that's sustainable, like agricultural waste. Additionally, we utilize coconuts, but most of it is actually exported. And so the usefulness of developing activated carbon filters from agricultural waste, especially ones that are locally sourced, is that it can be sourced from the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, when can I get these filters in the store? I mean, I imagine you're just in the research phase, right? But people must be asking you all the time, hey, I want to get some of this stuff.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of interest into these renewable activated carbon filters. However, we're still doing a significant amount of research. And in particular, we want to start upgrading them in terms of making them more beneficial for water treatment facilities. So making them in a controlled particle size, like granular size. In addition to that, we want to see what the effects of these different growth seasons could have on the activated carbon, because that's probably one of the main issues, is that you could have sort of a heterogeneity in sort of the growth cycle. And we expect that should also transform into modifying the properties of the activated carbon that's coming out of these agricultural resources. And so now we're trying to look into that as well.
You sound like a carbon expert. What's on the carbon frontier, the carbon capture frontier that you would like to see happen?
A big thrust of the research that we're doing is developing sorbents that are able to remove greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane out of the air. And we're actually trying to utilize that as building blocks to make similar materials that we're making today out of fossil fuels. So that's something that's really exciting for us.
When you capture it in the carbon, does it stay in the carbon? I mean, could you use it to build other things with it and lock it up forever?
So for example, we have a material that can capture carbon dioxide and turn into a carbonate, which is basically solidified carbon. And so you can store it as a form of rock. That's something that's being studied right now. We're on the other end of it in terms of we're trying to make some uses out of the captured carbon. So capturing CO2 and methane and converting that into synthesis gas, which is often a building block to make further things like gasoline or to make ethanol or ethylene, which can also be building blocks to make other materials like polymers as well.
Sounds very interesting. Wishing you a lot of luck on this, Dr. Abdulaziz. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dr. Candace Leslie Abdulaziz, Assistant Professor of Chemical and Environmental Engineering at UC Riverside. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, a biological explanation for why we get sick when it's cold outside. It turns out the nose knows. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you haven't noticed, and who hasn't, we are now in the cold and flu season. It's the time of the year when it's cold outside and you're more likely to see people sneezing and coughing, of course, the classic hallmarks of a respiratory infection. What's interesting about this time of the year is that it's usually assumed that the reason so many more people get sick is because we spend more time together locked up indoors. But new research out of Harvard Medical School and Northeastern University finds that there's a biological reason for the seasonal variation, and it all goes back to your nose. Joining me now to talk about this breakthrough is my guest, Dr. Benjamin Blyer, associate professor at Mass Eye and Ear and senior author of this study. He's based in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Great to be here.
You know, I am so glad to hear what you have learned because, you know, my mom always told me to bundle up outside in the cold or I'm going to get sick. But now along comes your research and it turns out that mom was sort of right. The cold air does have something to do with it. Cold air when it gets into your nose. Tell us what you've uncovered.
Well, yeah, it does turn out that our mothers and grandmothers were right all along, which perhaps is not surprising. But, you know, our study looked at the function of viruses as they get into the nose and how our body fights against them. And you can kind of break our study down into two parts. The first is we actually discovered a novel innate immune mechanism or a way that our immune system fights off viruses as soon as they enter our nose. And then the second part of the study was to look at how that function is actually impaired when we're exposed to cold air. So the first part of the study asked the question, how does our nose fight and prevent viruses from infecting the cells? And what we found was a very interesting mechanism, which actually takes off on some research we had done several years prior with regards to bacteria. And essentially what we found is that when you inhale a virus, the front of the nose is really the first part that the virus sees and impacts on those cells. That essentially alerts the nose that the virus is present because it binds to a receptor, which is called a toll-like receptor. Now, these receptors are actually evolutionarily coded in our bodies to already recognize these viruses, even if we've never actually been exposed to them before. But this sets off this cascade of events within the nose that results in three very important features of the immune response. The first is that the cells release what we like to call a swarm of extracellular vesicles. You can think of these as like little bubbles that are released from the cells into the nasal mucus. And we found that when a virus is introduced to the nose, about 160% more of these little bubbles are released into the mucus. But it's not just the number of these bubbles that changes, it's actually the composition, how these little bubbles are packaged. So the first thing we found is that these bubbles are actually decorated on the surface with the same receptors that the virus uses to get into our cells. But the receptors are actually increased up to 20 times. So there's 20 times more of these receptors on the surface of these vesicles. So essentially they act as little decoys. So the virus will bind to these vesicles and get mopped up before they ever have a chance to bind to the cells. So that's sort of the first way that these vesicles work. The second is that on the inside of these vesicles, these bubbles, there's a whole array of complex molecules that actually kill the viruses. Now, we looked specifically at a type of molecule called a microRNA, and in this case, microRNA 17, which is a microRNA which has been previously shown to have antiviral effects. And we found that these vesicles have up to 13 times more microRNA 17 than before you were exposed to the virus. And so essentially, these vesicles bind to the virus because they act as these decoys, and then the virus is inactivated by the presence of this high concentration of microRNA. So, you know, this is a really cool mechanism because this is essentially what we're finding is that this is your body's immune system leaving the body itself to go into the outside world to protect itself against the viruses before the virus can actually bind to the cell. The analogy we like to use is it's like a hornet's nest. So when the hornets are aware of an intruder, they swarm out of the nest to go attack the intruder before they have a chance to get into the nest itself.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, we thought so as well. now that was the first part of the study, but you know, when we were thinking about this, we know that this whole response, everything that we're talking about, is happening really at the front of the nose. You know, the front of the nose is the part of the body that's most exposed to the external environment, all the bacteria and viruses and fungus in the air and other irritants. And we inhale about 10,000 liters of air a day. So you can see that the front of our nose is constantly being assaulted with this type of external irritants and again, pathogens. But at the same time, we realize, well, not only is it exposed to what's in the air, but it's also exposed to the temperature of the air itself. And so if there's any part of the body that's going to be sensitive to the changes in temperature in our environment, it's going to be the front of the nose, because this is exactly the area that first is impacted by that cold air before it, the body has time to warm and humidify it, so that by the time it gets into our lungs, it's actually at body temperature and at about 100% humidity.
Hmm.
So that was what kicked off the second part of our study, asking what is the effect of that cold air on the immune response.
And the second part, you talked about what happens when it gets cold in your nose?
Exactly. You know, we wanted this study to really reflect what happens in live people. And so what we did was we took little tiny temperature probes called a thermocouple, and using a small scope, we were actually able to guide this into the noses of healthy volunteers and measure the change in their nose, in different places in their nose, at different external temperatures. And what we found is that if you go from room temperature down to about 40 degrees, just that change in temperature externally drops the temperature in the nose about 5 degrees Celsius or about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we then applied that same fairly modest drop in temperature to the studies that we just described about the immune response. And we found that in all three of these important effects were all impacted negatively by just this small change in temperature. So for example, the number of these vesicles that are released dropped by about 40%.
Wow.
The amount of that protective microRNA dropped by about 25%. And the number of the receptors that we discussed dropped by about up to 75%. So in all of these different types of mechanisms, we have this decline in function. And what that translated to, what we found in culture, was that there was almost a doubling of the amount of virus able to replicate within the cells, again, just by this small temperature drop. And so essentially what this means is that when we're exposed to cold temperature in the front of the nose, the immunity, our ability to fight off these viruses, drops by about half. And so essentially, it only takes about half as much virus to cause an infection in any individual as we get into these colder months. And again, this was even just a drop to 40 degrees.
That's amazing. My question to you then is, now that we're dealing with COVID and our noses and we're wearing masks, if the mask keeps your nose warmer because you're recirculating, right, all that warm air, could that help you fight off a COVID virus as well as a cold virus?
Yeah. So, you know, you hit the nail right on the head there, which is, you know, now that we understand this novel response, how do we use it to our advantage to prevent infection? And I think what you described is really the most short-term actionable item that we can do. I think what we've shown is that we know that masks prevent us from being exposed to the virus, but just as you said, now we believe that these masks also preserve this cushion of warm air in front of our noses and further reduce our ability to be impaired from the infection, which essentially means that all this time, masks have probably been acting in two different ways. And that probably responds to why they're so effective with prevention of viruses.
So what are the implications of this discovery then for treating upper respiratory infections?
Well, you know, this discovery really, as I mentioned, pertains to the innate immune response. This is the immune response that prevents us from getting the infection in the first place. This is different than the adaptive immune response, which is, for example, what happens when we get vaccinated. That's why vaccinations take weeks to kick in for our antibodies to develop. So what we're talking about here is really prevention as opposed to treatment. What we found is that essentially when the body is convinced that there's a virus present, it kicks off this entire response. So if we can develop topical sprays, for example, that mimic the presence of a virus without the actual pathogenicity or the injurious part of the virus, then we can fool the nose into thinking a virus is present and increase the amount of these protective vesicles, even without having to actually be exposed to the virus.
Well, I want to thank, this is great. Great to learn. Great to have you on and tell us about it. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Dr. Benjamin Blyer, Associate Professor at Mass Eye and Ear and senior author of this study. He's based in Boston. Have you ever heard of a glass frog? There are these little frogs found all over Central and South America. And what's incredible about them is that they look green from the top, But if you flip one over, it looks like, you guessed it, glass. You'll see their hearts, their intestines, the bones, everything. But as these frogs doze off, something almost magical happens. The frogs disappear. Well, almost. Here to tell us how these frogs pull off such a neat magic trick is my guest, Dr. Carlos Taboada, biologist at Duke University based in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me here.
You're welcome. Let's get into the details because this is some amazing trick. How do the frogs do it?
What we found basically is that the animals can pull out 90% of their red blood cells when they sleep and basically aggregate all of those cells inside of the livers. Basically, they remove most of the pigments that would normally create an opaque animal, like us, for example.
That's really interesting. Why does it only happen when they're sleeping?
We're still trying to figure that out. What we know is that when they sleep, in a way, they are less aware of predators. They become transparent and they reduce their metabolic rates. In a way, it's a trade-off. They can do it while they sleep if they stay motionless, without a big oxygen supply. When they're awake, they need to meet their metabolic needs because they start chasing prey, they start breeding, vocalizing, and they need more oxygen. So it's then when they become opaque and cannot pack their red blood cells anymore.
Is it possibly a defense mechanism for when they're sleeping, when they get transparent, that they're not seen so easily by predators?
That's interesting. I mean, there's some evidence that shows that transparency can help them camouflage. And that's what we also found. I mean, the optical properties are like a leaf. So basically, they match the vegetation perfectly where they sleep during the day. There's evidence that some predators might not see them during this time, because in this case, transparency works really well because we are used to seeing animals in terms of reflected light. All of the colors that we see in nature come from the way the light reflects on a surface. In this case, we need to think about animals being viewed through leaves and also like on reflected light. So this is a really complex form of camouflage that might help.
When you discovered that all the red blood cells were sort of heading to the liver, how surprising was that for you?
It was amazing. We had never seen anything like that because transparency was a mystery in glass frogs. But then after we found out, we started doing some research and discovered that there's some sort of ancestral mechanism in frogs. I mean, there's some evidence that other European common frogs, under like really specific experimental conditions that induce some sort of like induced coma in really well like oxygenated environments and really cold temperatures, they can store to some extent some red blood cells. They do that and in a way that could mimic a hibernation or torpor physiology. In this case, it was really surprising to see that glass frogs could push this to the limit, go from like around 40% storage to like 90% of the whole pool. And they could do it like even at high temperatures and every day on a circadian rhythm basis. That was the most interesting thing. Not only the amount that they could store in the livers, but also that they could do it at really, really high temperatures and daily.
That's amazing. You know, I imagine if you're packing a whole lot of red blood cells into one tiny space, as you said, that's what happens. Couldn't that cause some problems? I mean, is their liver specially made to be able to handle all of this?
In a way, they do. The liver increases its volume by like 40% when they pack all of their red blood cells. There's two distinctive traits in the livers. One is that they are covered with mirrors-like structures that are millions and millions of nanocrystals packed inside of a tissue that basically help them reflect most of the light, so we cannot see the red blood cells through the livers. And the other thing that is important is that in many other vertebrates, the livers are pretty distensible. They have like capillaries, which in livers are called sinusoids, that is the place where most of the interchanges of metabolites occur. The fact that they do it in a way requires other adaptations that allow them to aggregate all of the red blood cells without triggering a clot. That's what would normally happen to other animals for those concentrations and packing of red blood cells.
But somehow the frogs can do it without getting a blood clot.
They can do it. They can do it pretty well. While at the same time, they can still clot when they need it. Even when they are sleeping, in their liver, everything is fine. But if the animals are injured, for example, by a predator, they can still clot locally. Hmm. So their whole coagulation system is functional, but they can in a way split two functions. One is clotting normally and non-clotting pathologically.
Well, if they can store all this blood in the liver without it coagulating, and they can do all this magical stuff with it, is there anything that we could apply to human medicine to learn from the frog?
Oh, certainly. Normally, when there are like pathological clots, people are treated with anticoagulants, and these anticoagulants, sometimes they can induce some excessive bleeding in patients. We don't really know yet the mechanisms that this frog used to basically avoid the formation of a big clot, but certainly they deserve some research to figure it out. They clearly have like a way to compartmentalize different pathways of coagulation, and they can somehow prevent it, probably using a local anticoagulant. And so we need to find those genetic tricks that probably do something translational. That is something that we are exploring right now, and hopefully we'll have some results in the near future.
Okay. Well, you come back and tell us about it, okay? When you find that.
I'd be happy to.
Well, thank you, doctor, for taking time to be with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me here.
Dr. Carlos Tapawada is a biologist at Duke University based in Durham, North Carolina. If you'd like to see these frogs hide their blood, visit sciencefriday.com/glassfrogs. Before we go, though, we want to give a big Science Friday welcome to our new listeners at KALW in San Francisco. Welcome aboard. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.